I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Ask the Investigators. As we focus on the management of patients with gastroesophageal cancers, this is a satellite meeting to the 2021 AACR Virtual Annual Meeting. We're thrilled to have an awesome faculty, Dr. Joe Chow from the City of Hope, and Dr. Yelena Janjigian from Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. We're here to talk about what I think might be one of the most confusing areas, particularly in the last year, in all of medical oncology. And I'm really looking forward to our faculty further straightening it out for me, because every time I hear about it, I learn a little bit more. What an amazing year it's been. Just to make it interesting, as everybody knows, you know, we have a real rounds-like approach to our work. And this past year in the pandemic, we experimented with a new technique where I sit down with people ahead of time and pull some cases and get some questions on video for our live faculty. So I met with another investigator who's done a lot of research in this field, Dr. Dan Catanacci, and Dan pulled 7 cases from his practice. So we're gonna make rounds with him. That's the agenda for our meeting. We're gonna go from one patient, just like we're walking down a clinic hall, seeing a bunch of patients and getting your reactions. And just before we get started, just to take a little bit of a breath, Joe, just kind of curious, and maybe you could just put a little bit in perspective the amazing developments that have occurred in this field over the past year. Any, you know, major highlights from your point of view that you want to point out?
Yeah, understandably, a lot to digest, but in many ways, this is a good problem for us to have after having gone so many years without positive data. So, you know, and the fact that we now are looking at pembrolizumab with its recent FDA approval in first-line esophageal, both squamous and adenocarcinoma, and then FDA approval in terms of nivolumab in first-line gastric. Then we have to subsequently figure out what are the next steps. So I think with that, it's a good problem to have.
So Yelena, you know, one of the things that to me has been most confusing is sorting out the new data on checkpoint inhibitors and also trying to tie in the PD-L1 levels that are now, you know, reported as CPS. Oncologists in practice, of course, they are used to using TPS, for example, in lung cancer. Now they've got to adjust to this. Any comments before we get started? The first couple cases deal with that. Again, about the issue of PD-L1 assays in gastroesophageal cancer.
Sure, of course. Yes, your point about accurate testing for G junction gastric and esophageal cancer is critical. We care about CPS score, combined positivity score, that takes into account both stromal tumor staining as well as tumor staining. What we do know is that inter-observer variability is quite more prevalent for CPS than TPS. In other words, if you have two pathologists or two doctors sitting together, they may not score in the same way for CPS as with TPS. There's a lot more reliable concordance. Where does that leave us? Well, luckily, there's pluses and minuses to it, but for esophageal cancer, pembrolizumab is now FDA approved irrespective of PD-L1 status. This was by KEYNOTE-590, and on what subset of patients we can give nivolumab to. In the NCCN guidelines currently, it's for CPS greater than or equal to 5, and that's the number you need to know. There's a lot of variability between different assays. There's at least 5 or 6 CLIA approved assays out there. 28-8 and 22C3 are the most common ones for gastric, and those appear to be similar in concordance. But keep an eye out and read your pathology reports carefully.
So again, before we sort of dive into this, and we spent entire hours just on this topic, IOs and gastroesophageal cancer, we're just going to sort of touch a little bit of that. But just to put out a couple other biomarkers that are definitely going to come up in the conversation, let's just get them out on the table right now, Joe, which is TMB and MSI status. How does that figure in with these patients? And of course, we're talking about generally metastatic disease, but now we're starting to look at in the adjuvant or post-neoadjuvant setting.
Yeah, so MSI, you know, in terms of deficiencies and mismatch repair, in many ways, that's already linked to TMB, given you're not able to repair subsequent DNA replication defects. You get a lot of mutations. And of course, we know from other tumor types that translates to, you know, exquisite responses to PD-1 inhibitors. And though we don't really have any FDA approval in earlier lines of earlier setting, we do have some data. You know, there's now subset analyses from KEYNOTE-62, which it shows, very favorable survival with upfront pembrolizumab. We did get a tease of that data in terms of CheckMate 649. The subset of patients were MSI high there, at least in the PD-L1 CPS5 subset. I would be interested to really see what all patients in that trial were MSI high, given not all are necessarily having high PD-L1, though mostly are, at least PD-L1 positive with a one cutoff. In terms of TMB, I mean, really, I don't necessarily view that independently of MSI. You know, we do have data sets in which TMB and MSI are actually closely linked.
So I will say, you all throw around CheckMate 649 like everybody knows it. But remember, the general medical oncologists, they walk over to bladder cancer, they walk to lung cancer. There are a whole lot of other CheckMates and KEYNOTEs and everything else. So real challenge for being a general medical oncologist. And so let's just dive into the granularity of managing patients. And Dan, he came up with some things I never even thought about. There's such practical stuff. Let's start out with this first case. You have a 54-year-old man, MS stable gastroesophageal junction adenocarcinoma. His PD-L1 level, the CPS is 20, so it's elevated. The patient's HER2 negative. This is a patient who presents with dysphagia and weight loss, and his imaging shows metastatic disease in the liver. The patient gets FOLFOX and pembrolizumab, and then continues on pembrolizumab maintenance. Eventually, the patient progressed, got FOLFIRI remucirumab. Here's Dan's questions to you.
Do use nivolumab or pembrolizumab for G-junction adenocarcinomas, where, of course, we have data that might support either with CheckMate 649 and KEYNOTE 590, respectively. And similarly, along those lines, as a backbone chemotherapy, do you prefer cisplatin or oxaliplatin? With the dosing of pembrolizumab, given the study, the KEYNOTE 590 study, it was given in a three-week schedule with cisplatin-based chemotherapy. We know now that the label and NCCN guidelines both allow for any platinum, including oxaliplatin. Given that many of our patients with esophageal cancer get FOLFOX rather than, say, CAPOX because they can't swallow when they're diagnosed, how are you dosing the pembrolizumab? Are you changing to the every six-week schedule to keep them on track to not have them come back an extra week? Or are you staying with an every three-week schedule?
So, Yelena, a whole bunch of practical, important questions. Any thoughts?
Sure. Well, oxaliplatin is the less toxic of the platinums, typically. And so we do prefer oxaliplatin. In most modern trials and in standard practice, FOLFOX is the backbone that we use in combination, exactly as was shown in this case. These patients are nutritionally compromised, so it would be very difficult to have them come in every three-week schedule. So therefore, every two-week schedule lends itself well. I tend to not use pembro every 6 weeks for personal or sort of experience and anecdotal data to suggest there may be a little bit more toxicity. And again, nothing published, but in MSI cases, I've seen the efficacy that was subpar. So if I am to do FOLFOX, I tend to stick to nivolumab for adenocarcinomas. Again, that's not an issue. I guess theoretically, if there's a squamous case and I really wanted to do FOLFOX, I would then probably use pembro every 6 weeks and not make the patient come in one extra week off, because that's very disruptive. So in that sense, oxaliplatin, FOLFOX, I do use nivolumab and pembrolizumab and tend to stick to every two-week schedule, so nivolumab lends itself better.
So, Joe, any thoughts? And, it's interesting going across different, tumor specialties, how people react to the Q6-week pembro. I have heard people say that they think anecdotally maybe there's more flu-like symptoms or general immune whatever in the fused Q6-weeks. Any thoughts about that and some of these other practical issues that Yelena was commenting on and Dan was questioning?
Yeah, unfortunately, we only have anecdotal evidence to work on. And, personally myself, I've also, tried out the FOLFOX and every 6 week pembrolizumab to spare the patients the extra, visit in terms of having to have asynchronous dosing. But in many ways, in terms of whether to use pembrolizumab and nivolumab, I honestly, I do consider them interchangeable in terms of first line therapy with chemotherapy, but patient access is an issue. So if it's in the situation in which squamous cell carcinoma, we have currently data with pembrolizumab, then that's where we'll apply pembrolizumab.
So of course, Yelena, this is the approval that you were talking about with pembrolizumab just really a couple weeks ago. Any comments about the data was presented as, I mean, what an amazing year, first line therapy and metastatic disease is bang, all of a sudden IOs are here. Anything you want to say about this study in particular, Yelena?
So this was a primarily squamous cell cancer study because it's esophageal, primarily accrued outside of the U.S. Adenocarcinoma was a small component. And the driver here was the CPS greater than 10 category. As you can see here, the hazard ratio is a whopping 0.57. In squamous cell cancer, higher PD-L1 expression is more prevalent. So these people are driving the majority of the benefit. But nonetheless, because in the intent to treat population, the curves also separated very generously, the FDA and, you know, I think some of us were surprised at how generous the FDA approval was, and Joe can comment on that. But, you know, they approved irrespective of histology, irrespective of PD-L1 status. It does take the pressure off the pathologists and the oncologist a bit to scramble and sort of validate all of these biomarkers and to be, how sure are you if somebody is truly CPS of 10 versus 5 versus 3? But nonetheless, I think it will slow down drug development a bit because less people will go on trials now because everyone can get Pembro outside of a trial.
So Joe, any comments on this? And also the Nevo study that was presented at ESMO, the CheckMate 649 trial. Can you comment on what was seen there?
So with the, at least, CheckMate 649, it was also esophageal, but only adenocarcinomas. You know, there was no squamous cell carcinomas in this randomized phase 3. If anything, we'll have to wait for one protocol number less, CheckMate 648. So that's the squamous cell randomized phase 3, but we don't have data with nivolumab in the frontline setting there yet, though I believe accrual has completed. You bring up KEYNOTE-62, which, you know, unfortunately was a negative study in the first line setting with chemotherapy plus pembrolizumab, but that was more for gastric and all GE junction, predominantly CWRT 2s and 3s. And, you know, and there, you know, this is why it's kind of controversial in some ways, the FDA approval, because in KEYNOTE-62, even though it was a CPS 1 or higher population, there was no CPS 0s. It was a pre-selected population. Though you saw the curve separate, you know, you can also argue maybe the trial was underpowered, but it, you know, didn't meet its pre-specified endpoint in terms of improving progression-free and overall survival. So that's why we don't have a pembrolizumab frontline approval for gastric currently. But yes, it makes it easier in terms of the lack of PD-L1 assay companion diagnostic with esophageal. I think at least for me, in terms of having that patient in front of me with esophageal cancer and whether or not to have them get chemotherapy plus pembrolizumab if they're PD-L1 CPS less than 10, it really, like, what are my alternatives, so to speak? If there's another trial that may be more attractive or more promising, then maybe I'll consider that. But if there's no other viable options, then in many ways, you know, do we really want to deny that patient, you know, access to pembrolizumab when you know, the FDA approval is there?
So let's go into another case. Yelena, this is a 56-year-old man with localized adenocarcinoma of the esophagus, MS stable, and the CPS is 10. Again, a patient who presented with dysphagia and weight loss. This patient went to neoadjuvant therapy with carbopaclitaxel and then went to surgery. And the question here is about adjuvant therapy, which this patient actually got adjuvant nivolumab. Interestingly, developed some skin problems, autoimmune dermatitis, and hypothyroidism that ended up having treatment being discontinued, and he's now NED followed on surveillance. Here's Dan.
This is a patient also with dysphagia, biopsy confirmed adeno, HER2 negative, CPS 10. had received chemo RT and then surgery, but unfortunately has an R1 resection and a poor response to therapy, grade 3 pathologic response. So the questions here, based on this case, in a patient with poor response but with an R1 positive margin, would you consider adjuvant nivolumab? Because, of course, the recently published CheckMate 577 study in the New England Journal of Medicine, of course, did not include patients with R1 resection. They had to have an R0 resection. So this is a little bit outside of the eligibility criteria, but all else equal here, with a poor response, no obvious metastatic disease, very high risk of recurrence, obviously, and a high PD-L1 score, would you consider using adjuvant nivolumab in this case? And then as a second question out of that, would your decision change if it was a CPS score of 0, PD-L1?
So, Yelena, any thoughts about his questions in terms of the fact there's an R1 a resection here? Also, his question, what would you do if the CPS were 0?
There's a critical difference, right, that I didn't actually get from the slide, but Dan brought up. R1 resection is not the same, and the treatment would not be considered adjuvant. For patients with R1 resection, these are stage 4 disease. So what the question you need to answer first is, where is the positive margin? Can I do something about it, such as local radiation therapy or brachytherapy, to try to sterilize that margin? Even if the patient is CPS 30, Nivo is not going to treat and address that area adequately. So you really need to try to do your patient a full sort of service and try to sterilize that margin. If you can't, and if it was attempted and it's negative, you know, wasn't successful, then the question is what to do then. The option is to treat and treat as if they're metastatic. It's certainly the number of cycles and so on that will be in, or what are you treating? How do you know you're addressing what you're hoping to address? In some cases, you know, here it's obviously PD-L1 is high. If you couldn't radiate, you would consider nivolumab, but this is really for stage 4 disease. And what I would do, since they got carboplatin radiation and had an R1 resection, if the patient is fit and their functional status permits, I would just start FOLFOX Nivo, treating them as if they were stage 4, which is what they are. Adjuvant paradigms do not apply to R1 resection cases.
So just before I get to Joe's thought about this, if the patient did have an R0 resection and was in a more classic adjuvant situation, again, PD-L1 is 0 or CPS is 0, treat or not?
Absolutely. For people with node positive and persistent disease with R0 resection, the disease-free survival was doubled with addition of adjuvant nivolumab. It's relatively well tolerated, and there's no other proven therapy to help these patients. So yes, the degree of benefit for CPS 0 patients is probably less so, but I would treat. And the other caveat is about thyroiditis and dermatitis. I think in a patient with, you know, adjuvant nivolumab, it's reasonable to stop. But typically in a stage 4 case, if it's mild dermatitis, you treat through it and you give topical steroids. And for thyroiditis, you just replete. You don't stop.
So again, Joe, any thoughts about this case, the R1 issue here and the CPS score?
I agree. I think it depends on where the margin's at, because, you know, having a, non-negative margin resection, that's pretty uncommon after chemo radiation. I mean, we know from the cross-trial data that, you know, over 90% of patients are typically margin negative. I mean, that's what established neoadjuvant chemo radiation as the standard of care. If it's a circumferential margin, then I think it's more, you know, I mean, that's not uncommon to see, but, you know, how do you really, you know, clear that? I think the other nuance is, it seems like Dan only brought up the PD-L1 marker testing on the initial biopsy. But in terms of the kind of exploratory PD-L1 CPS analyses that the, you know, CheckMate 577 publication, you know, it's now out in New England Journal of Medicine, it was all on the resected specimens. You know, we actually do have data in which, you know, PD-L1 status may change. You know, I think a more tricky question, if it was PD-L1 10 initially and then now CPS 0, would that, you know, sway you to not give, you know, adjuvant nivolumab? It wouldn't for me, you know, because, you know, really that whole, you know, PD-L1 CPS less than 5 you know, having less benefit. It was exploratory, but you know, at least the hazard ratio still, you know, lean towards the side of giving, you know, adjuvant nivolumab.
So, Yelena, a question from the chat room. Pre-op FLOT versus cross regimen for GE adenocarcinoma.
Sure. So carboplatin is fallen out of favor for adenocarcinomas. There was a cooperative group study that compared FOLFOX RT versus carboplatin RT, and it was a complicated study, so I won't go into it. But essentially, it appears to be that with 5-FU oxaliplatin, so capecitabine oxaliplatin or anything like that, the path CR rate is higher and survival is better with when you add it with radiation. So we do not give carboplatin with RT anymore for adenos. For squamous, you can still do it, but not for adenos. So I prefer to give FLOT unless I'm worried about possibility of R1 resection. In that case, you need to discuss very closely with the surgeons, right? If it's a mid-thoracic and proximal G-junction tumors, the risk of R1 resection, as was shown with Dan's case, is possible. But for G-junction cardiac tumors, we can usually get away without radiation, and that's what I like to do, and give FLOT.
So, Joe, maybe you can comment a little bit on the CheckMate 577 study that really changed the approach to adjuvant therapy in this situation. Any comments, what was seen there?
So patients who were enrolled onto the study, they all had neoadjuvant chemoradiation. And actually, there wasn't any stipulation about exactly what kind of chemotherapy was given with their radiation. So that, you know, there could have been patients who had FOLFOX radiation, some patients with cisplatin and 5-FU radiation, and of course, you know, carboplatin paclitaxel radiation as well. But then really the key for inclusion was, you know, having a margin negative resection, but then still having residual tumor, you know, not having a pathologic complete response, given historically we know the prognosis is worse for those patients compared to those who do, you know, achieve a complete pathologic response, you know, no viable tumor cells on the pathological resection specimen. And, you know, this is very compelling data in terms of disease-free survival being much improved with 1 year of adjuvant nivolumab therapy. You know, placebo was you know, the adequate, was the right control to use. It was at least a 2-to-1 randomization, to help bolster accrual to the study. It took a while to accrue. Yes. You know, that's why they had to actually amend the study. Originally, it was an overall survival primary endpoint, but they reasonably used disease-free survival as a surrogate. And just looking at these, you know, the way the curves are separating, and the fact that actually they reported very little, you know, crossover, so to speak, in terms of patients on the placebo arm getting PD-1 inhibitors and lines of therapy, I think overall survival will be positive with longer follow-up. You know, currently the overall survival events are still too immature to report out.
So, Yelena, what are your recommendations for treating resectable MSI-high gastric cancer? What are your thoughts about that, Yelena? And I guess the issue of pre-op chemo.
Although MSI-high tumors are rare, we do see them in about 15 to 20% of localized gastric cancer. And if you are a patient with MSI-high gastric cancer and you receive chemotherapy before getting to surgery, your likelihood of overall survival is actually is less than if you went straight to surgery. That's the MAGIC study that Lizzie Smith analyzed. In other words, you can potentially harm your patients with giving them pre-op chemotherapy if they're MSI-high. Why is that? Well, the benefit to neoadjuvant and adjuvant chemotherapy, depending on what study you look at, is, you know, 15, maybe 20% if you really are enthusiastic and it's high-risk disease. And you may actually suppress the patient's immune system if they're MSI-high and harm them. So I prefer in MSI-high patients to refer them straight to surgery. And again, the important problem there is, are you going to be able to, and you ask that to your surgeon, are you going to be able to achieve an R0 resection? If the answer is yes, in other words, if it's a distal gastric cancer or a location of the tumor where surgery is not a problem, go ahead and take it out, and then you can decide whether or not to give them adjuvant therapy. Asian data suggests that you won't harm them with adjuvant treatment, with capecitabine oxaliplatin or just capecitabine alone. And certainly the majority of the benefit is from doublet therapy. So it would be fine to skip FLOT.
So we're going to go on now and talk about a couple of cases of HER2 positive disease. I was just flashing on the fact that for the last couple of years, we've been doing satellites at the San Antonio Breast Cancer Meeting for like 20 years. And for the last couple of years, we've done satellites just on HER2 positive breast cancer. You imagine, I mean, just for 2 hours, HER2 positive. And I think that's coming for gastroesophageal cancer.
I hope so.
But it's, anyhow, so Dan has a 68-year-old man with relapsed MMS stable adenocarcinoma of the esophagus. The patient's HER2 positive. The PD-L1, the CPS is zero. The patient started out with neoadjuvant carboplatin and surgery, was then found out liver disease, got treated with first-line FOLFOX trastuzumab, disease progression, gets second-line FOLFIRI ramucirumab, and then gets trastuzumab deratuxin. Actually responds to the T-DXd, but develops a pretty low-grade interstitial lung disease or pneumonitis. Here's Dan.
One question is, in the perioperative setting, do you use anti-HER2 therapy in a patient who has HER2 amplification? And when patients do progress at each line of therapy in the metastatic disease in the palliative setting, do you reassess HER2 status? And how do you do that? Do you repeat biopsies, or do you do circulating tumor DNA in the blood, or do you do both? Patient had liver and lung disease, and so when they progressed, they were on FOLFIRI and ramucirumab, and when they received the trastuzumab deruxtecan, those lesions all were either controlled or responding. That was nice to see, but after 6 months, they got some pneumonitis. I've had patients either present with cough, like a dry cough, or just feeling short of breath, and either or both. And in this patient, it was more the short of breath problem. What are the future aspects and considerations of trastuzumab deruxtecan in terms of trying to move it earlier in lines of therapy, earlier in the perioperative setting even? And what about in combination with various agents, whether it's chemotherapy, radiation, immunotherapy, other targeted therapies?
So much to talk about. Lena, maybe we can begin in terms of the ILD. We saw some more data presented actually at this AACR meeting, looking at, I guess, picking up all the studies that are out there right now, 8 studies, 879 patients. Not sure if anything particularly exciting or new came out of it. It looked like it reinforced a lot of messages we'd heard before. Any comments on what we've learned about the ILD as time has gone on, Yelena?
Sure. Well, what we know about ILD is it's extremely rare, but it does occur, and you can never let your guard down. It can happen, you know, in anywhere from just after 1 or 2 doses, because the dosing is every 3 weeks. So you could get it 6 weeks into it, or you can get 6 months or 8 months into it. And most people, you know, if they do get it, it is relatively mild, and you can probably pick it up if you look at their scans carefully enough. Often it's, you know, you're looking at their liver mets or their, you know, peritoneal carcinomatosis, and you sort of ignore the lung findings, but really read the fine print, because these findings can be very subtle, you know, because the radiologist doesn't know what the patient is on, and, you know, everyone sort of has stuff in their lungs. So you just really have to read the fine print. And if you're vigilant and you train your patients to not minimize their symptoms, but over-report, dry cough, any sort of changes in exercise tolerance, then you won't miss it. And if you pick it up at early, grade 1 or grade 2, the likelihood of serious events is low. And most cases are very much reversible if you stop treatment. I think, you know, in gastric cancer, because we do give higher doses, 6.4 mg per kg, theoretically, the risk could be higher. That being said, because ultimately our patients don't get as many cycles of therapy, we have not had, as many grade 5 events reported in trials as were reported in breast. So I'm hopeful we'll be able to use these agents. We just have to be mindful, and we'll be able to use them safely, even as Dan, you know, alluded to, in first line setting. And we do have trials underway exploring that data.
Yeah, actually, in this study that was reported at AACR, I guess the all stage or all grade ILD with breast is around 15% versus 5% with gastric, but as you say, maybe you're treated less there. Curious also, Yelena, you've had so much experience with this agent. Do you see any quality of life issues with TDXD, chemo effects, alopecia, GI effects? I mean, it does have chemo in there.
Yes, exactly. So I think people coming off the age of IO therapies, you know, if you don't explain to your patients that this is chemotherapy, remember, it's essentially irinotecan. It has topoisomerase sort of payload, 8 molecules. So people do experience alopecia. They have mild LFT elevations. They have, you know, chemo sort of fatigue and malaise. But I've treated, you know, many patients in practice, and knock on wood, you know, if their disease is responding, they're willing to tolerate some of these chemotherapy side effects. But I think a lot of it is understanding and expectations. And if you explain to your patients, this is chemotherapy, you know, they will be ready for it.
Well, I mean, you know, it is chemotherapy, but it's extremely targeted. I mean, I hear lots of cases of people who cruise through, or I don't hear too many with, you know, full-blown chemo that cruise through. In your experience, Yelena, what fraction of patients just slide right through, no major deals?
It depends when you treat. So now TDXT, and we need to highlight that, even though the DESTINY-Gastric01 study was a third line and beyond study, the U.S. FDA, once again, generously approved it in trastuzumab refractory patients, so in second line. In my experience, if you give it to patients in second line where patients are fitter, they still eating okay, their functional status is pretty good, they tolerate it reasonably well. It's the later line of therapy patients who have peritoneal carcinomatosis, who already have less of a bone marrow reserve. They may have LFT abnormalities for other reasons, or have lung mets, or, you know, pleural effusions. Those patients don't tolerate it as well.
So, Joe, curious for your thoughts also about this paper that was just presented on ILD here at the AACR meeting. One of the things that was interesting that they put in there was that they had this adjudicating committee, and it looks like they could pick up the ILD in retrospect earlier than it was actually picked up, suggesting that maybe we could be a little bit, you know, more effective in diagnosing it. Any thoughts about that, Joe?
Yeah, no, I mean, also, you know, having participated in the DESTINY-Gastric02, you know, second line trial, yeah, there was this adjudicating committee, and you know, of course, it's be nice to have if we had that in reality and practice, but unfortunately, we don't. But I think Yelena, you know, she brings up a good point. You know, let's just be very vigilant. You know, looking at your scans. You know, just like how I look at the lungs for all my patients who are anti-PD-1 therapies, I'm going to make it a point to also look at the lungs for these patients on TDXD. I think to also, if it's okay to address some of the earlier questions by Dan in terms of using trastuzumab in the perioperative, or actually his patient, I believe, had neoadjuvant chemoradiation. We did have the RTOG 1010 trial. It was an oral presentation at ASCO. Unfortunately, it was negative. Adding trastuzumab to neoadjuvant chemoradiation in HER2-positive disease, it was a lot of hopes in terms of it being a positive study. But you know, when you look at the PFS and overall survival curves, they completely overlapped. Pathologic complete response rates were also the same, even with giving trastuzumab in the neoadjuvant setting. So I think we still have a lot of work to do in terms of you know, hopefully some biomarker correlates from that will give us some insights in terms of why that study wasn't positive, even though it was a biomarker select population.
So Joe, I'm just kind of curious. I'm going to ask Yelena the same question. What you see, what you've been seeing when you treat people. I mean, general medical oncologists, a lot of them haven't even used it once in this situation. I'm curious, you know, you look at the waterfall plot, it looks like people do really well. Does that sort of sync up with what you're seeing in the patients you're taking care of, Joe?
Yeah, no, I mean, when you see a response, it definitely is very encouraging to see, and by virtue of the fact that outside of trastuzumab, you know, we haven't had any positive data for all the other investigational agents that the breast oncologists get to use, and, you know, subsequently in the general medical oncology community, I'm sure they're prescribing as well. Though I do believe it's true that, you know, GI toxicities is something I run into, nausea, vomiting. You know, you do have to pre-medicate these patients with, you know, antiemetic regimens, just like chemotherapy. It's also borne out when you look at the randomized phase two data with SNE-Gastric01 that was published. It was actually more grade, you know, all grade toxicities and grade 3 or 4 toxicities compared to irinotecan, you know, another chemotherapeutic agent. I've also seen cytopenias in my experience as well. So, you know, but dose reductions are permissible. I mean, that's the other thing with the dosing of TDXD in gastric cancer. It's higher than what's in breast cancer. And it's by virtue of the fact that concerns about higher intratumoral heterogeneity, you know, probably a lower proportion of, you know, HER2 positive cells, you know, within your patient's tumors. And then ideally with the bystander effect, in which it's been borne out in preclinical studies, you can still have a lot of anti-tumor activity, even though there's maybe not as much HER2 signal within the patient's tumors.
And of course, Yelena, that bystander effect has caught a lot of excitement, mainly in breast, I think, up to this point, on the hope that maybe people with the so-called HER2 low disease might respond. I think that's being looked at in breast. I don't know if it's being looked at in any other cancers. Any thoughts about that?
Sure, of course. So in gastric cancer, there is a bystander effect is very much needed, even in HER2 positive tumors. And that's, I think, one of the main reasons why TDXD is successful, why other agents failed, such as T-DM1, where the bystander effect is not as profound. We do have some small data in HER2 IHC2 plus patients where there is some response. I don't think it's going to be exciting enough to explore this drug in just HER2 low or negative patients alone, but it does give us reassurance that even in patients where there, you know, a small percent of cells are positive and that's what you got on the biopsy and the rest of the tumor is HER2 negative, you may still see some shrinkage in HER2 positive disease and HER2 negative bystander disease.
So same question I asked Joe, Yelena. Again, we see the waterfall plot. It looks all exciting. Does that sort of sync up with what you're seeing clinically? I mean, do most people, you know, respond?
I've had really dramatic responses and complete responses in my practice. I use this drug quite a bit, both, you know, in clinical practice and in clinical trials. I do think it really is an important part of our, of our tool shed against HER2 positive gastric cancer.
So here's one of the questions I think would be real interesting to see what the audience thinks about, what you think about, and also what kind of trials are out there that might actually give us an answer to this question. So audience, what would you generally recommend a second line therapy in a patient, just like the one Dan presented, who gets a full foxtrastuzumab for first line treatment of HER2 positive adenocarcinoma of the GE junction? Would you go the ramucirumab paclitaxel route? Would you keep the trastuzumab going and switch chemotherapy a la as done in breast cancer all the time? Would you think about a checkpoint inhibitor? Or what about TDXD as an option also? And Joe, it looks like the most common answer by far in our audience is actually TDXD, way more than anything else. Along, you know, the next one down, way down, is ram-paclitaxel. How would you answer this question? You know, putting aside reimbursement, which I guess really isn't an issue, actually. So what do you do second line, Joe? What would you like to do?
Well, no one answered other. I mean, personally, myself, actually, I would put the patient on a trial
second-line trials. Okay, yeah, we know that. All right.
But I think, you know, until seeing the full DESTINY-Gastric02 trial, I mean, data, because that was second line, you know, because, you know, DESTINY-Gastric01, that was third line and beyond. And it was, you know, pretty much patients outside of the U.S. So we'll have second line data coming in terms of U.S. and Western patients. But I think at this point, you know, paclitaxel ramucirumab, you know, I still consider that the reference second line standard, especially if we don't know the HER2 status after first line therapy, because we know that, you know, HER2 again can be lost. You know, in the FDA labeling, it does, you know, at least state, consider rebiopsying your patient. And of course, you know, it's again controversial. You know, what if you biopsy, you know, because of intrapatient intratumor heterogeneity, you biopsy an area that's negative, and then It raises questions of doing ctDNA, which, you know, we do have data in which it can capture HER2 overexpression as well, but then also concerns about sensitivity there too. So to me, the safe answer is paclitaxel ramucirumab until we see and then the other issue with DESTINY-Gastric02 is patients were required to be re-biopsied and actually have central confirmation that their tumor was HER2 overexpressing before they went on to that trial. So we'll actually have you know, real prospective following of patients, you know, retaining HER2 overexpression and then seeing their subsequent response rates and toxicities.
So Joe, may I ask, do you not give T-DXd then in second line?
Not for second line. No, I do. I reserve it. I'm currently reserving it for third line, I'll be honest. Yeah, there we go. Controversy there for you, because that's currently where the data is. And
let's get out the boxing gloves and make this thing happen here.
I was surprised to hear it. Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah.
So, Yelena, what are your thoughts?
Well, you know, I think what Joe is saying is right on point. And I do think with this FDA approval, the, you know, it's a gift in a way, but in some ways it will slow down drug development, right? Because we had all these exciting trials starting up where now the comparator arm is, you know, a bust. Patients, after you convince people that you have HER2 positive disease, we got it targeted in second line setting, patients do not want to be randomized to Taxol Ramucirumab. In fact, my patients would, you know, would be really upset with me if I didn't offer them an FDA approved option, unless I'm doing something else in addition. And also, to be a devil's advocate, you know, in Gastric01, they didn't mandate rebiopsy. So I do agree that rebiopsying is important, and the FDA label does suggest it, but it doesn't mandate it. So the right answer is really trastuzumab deruxtecan. That's what's approved. It is disappointing, because I think trials are important, and we do, you know, there are exciting agents that we should be studying and exploring, especially in clinical trials, but trastuzumab deruxtecan is FDA approved.
When we were doing live meetings, I was so impressed by the presidential debates that we started to give everybody podiums. So, Joe, let's go back to you. One more chance at your retort to Yelena.
Sure. No. So because, you know, yeah, DESTINY-Gastric01, it's third line. You know, and really when I look at, you know, what you know, risk benefits, you know, I think the you know, paclitaxel ramucirumab, of course, has its toxicities as well, but it's, you know, it's cross-trial comparisons, unfortunately, but I do think GI toxicities are a bit on the lesser side with T-DXd. I think the cytopenias, you know, there's a lot of experience with managing them in you know, with paclitaxel ramucirumab. And I feel like you're not losing anything if you're reserving it for third line.
Well, that's the big question,
it's a big
right?
question. Yeah, it's a big question.
Are you going to be able to keep your patients well enough?
And at least maybe it's not the case in many, many others practices, but with at least 80%, you know, disease control rate with paclitaxel ramucirumab, you know, you still have that close to 30% response rate across all tumors. And then when I get to third line, you know, what are our options there? It's TAS-102, it's pembrolizumab, in which the response rates are, you know, unfortunately on the lower side. Then I feel like, well, we still have T-DXd that we can use as a third line option. And that's really where the data is at.
So the art of oncology, a couple more things I want to bring out about T-DXd. One in particular that I felt like I was studying the Talmud when I went through these cases with Dan, because he was bringing up liquid biopsies and biopsying the primary, biopsying, you know, and I never heard this degree of looking for heterogeneity in breast cancer. Really interesting. So I want to get into that in a second. But first, Yelena, can you just walk us through the New England Journal paper on T-DXd and gastric cancer? Anything in particular you want to comment on?
Yeah, sure. You know, so this was a randomized study in third line or fourth line Japanese patients, where patients are much fitter, more people get later lines of therapy. To give you a perspective on this, our first line CheckMate 649 study of FOLFOX nivolumab, only 30 to 40% went on to get second or third line, while a very similar study in Japan, 80 to 90% of them went on to have second or third line. So I wouldn't take it into sort of with guaranteed that patients are going to get third or fourth line. It's not a guaranteed. These patients had a dramatic response to third line in Japanese population, and the median OS of 12.5 months we have never seen before in a HER2-positive study, with obviously compared to physician control, physician choice chemotherapy has a ratio of 0.59. The toxicities is what we discussed, bone marrow suppression, lymphocyte count decrease, fatigue, and so on. And as you can see here, it is more toxic when it comes down to adverse events compared to physician choice chemotherapy, especially with any grade neutrophil count decrease and grade 3 and 4 neutrophil count decrease.
So, Yelena, can you kind of give your thoughts about this idea, and we'll get into this with the next case from Dan, but how hard do you look for heterogeneity? And what does the heterogeneity that you see in gastric or gastroesophageal cancer mean in terms of response to anti-HER therapy in general and T-DXd specifically?
Well, heterogeneity is the reason why there are so many negative studies in gastric cancer, because there it's not just HER2. You have co-occurring alterations, MET, RAS, EGFR, FGFR, all the Rs, right? And then furthermore, only a small group, a subset of patients or cells can be HER2 positive, and that HER2 clone may just die out and never come back. So heterogeneity is important, especially as we're studying, and we've published a lot on this, as we're studying which treatments to give patients in a trial. Practically, in clinical practice, I do look with liquid biopsy, but I don't rely on it because amplifications are not as easy to pick up in ctDNA, and also these assays are fraught with difficulty, so they may not be accurate, sensitive, or specific. So for me, the gold standard is still biopsies. For patients with primary tumor in place, we do endoscopies. We do check ctDNA more to look for other mechanisms of resistance. And occasionally we find that the biopsy is HER2 negative, but the ctDNA is HER2 positive. So we go by whichever is the most positive, and we offer HER2-directed therapy to the patient.
So let's bring out one more HER2 case, and then we'll move on to another topic. This is a 35-year-old patient with metastatic disease, actually had disease progression on T-DXd, and then went on to third-line FOLFIRI-Ramucirumab. Here's Dan.
She got FOLFOX with trastuzumab, standard of care, and she was doing well, responded for several months, and then started to get worsening dysphagia and also worsening pleural effusion after about 9 months on first-line therapy. At that time, again, we reassess HER2 status, and this was done by an EGD. And so the primary tumor did show persistent HER2 amplification, but circulating tumor DNA and the effusion cytology of the lung by FISH did not show HER2 amplification. So the patient was eligible for trastuzumab deruxtecan because some of her disease still had HER2 amplification. And she did get some improvement in the dysphagia once she started, but she had rapid progression of her lung disease and effusion by the first restaging scan. Destiny Gastric 4 is now a large phase 3 global study in the second line setting of trastuzumab deruxtecan versus PAC-RAM.
There is some suggestion, I think just mainly breast cancer, of benefit to patients who are, quote, HER2 low, so IHC 1 or 2.
Trastuzumab doesn't work at low levels. Now, if you're asking me about trastuzumab deruxtecan, that's a little different. I think I've seen mixed results about that, frankly.
So, Joe, just to close this out, you know, I think you could tell he was sort of alluding to the fact that maybe the fact that the pleural effusion was HER2 negative was maybe related to why it progressed there and seemed to respond in the primary. Any thoughts about sort of how far you can carry out this sort of heterogeneity thing?
And in some ways, to answer one of your earlier questions, how hard do you have to look for heterogeneity? Sometimes you don't have to look that hard. It'll just present itself, as Dan's case, very eloquently showed. The fusion didn't have HER2 overexpression. The other thing too is, in the NCCN guidelines, it is recommended, at least for future trial considerations, having NGS done on on your patients. So at least with the tumor tissue, you know, hopefully there's sufficient amount to do the HER2 and the PD-L1. But then when you do NGS, yeah, you can capture a lot of these co-alterations and other tyrosine kinase receptors that Elena had brought up. And the other thing, which, you know, sometimes you have to kind of ask for the data separately from whoever's doing the NGS testing for you. There's, of course, many different platforms out there now, but, you know, getting an estimated copy number, you know, in many ways, if you think about, you know, how NGS is the results are produced, it's the metagenomes of, you know, many, you know, the billions of cancer cells in that biopsy. So it's going to be, you know, a mixture of tumor cell populations, both HER2 overexpressing and HER2 negative. And then, you know, it kind of averages out in terms of that NGS readout. So if it's, you know, possibly a more homogeneous, you know, HER2 overexpressing tumor, then the copy number could be very high, you know, in terms of, you know, the readout from the NGS report versus being, you know, much lower level. So, you know, there is data, including from Yelena's studies that, you know, two copy number also correlates with benefit from anti-HER2 therapy.
So Yelena, in our slide deck, we have a bunch of ongoing trials that are, many of which you're involved with at the GI symposium recently. The trials in progress section talked about this Mountaineer 2 study looking at...
Yeah, it's good timing because somebody brought it up in the chat actually asking
about Well, also the fact that they use ctDNA as part of the trial design. I'm curious, you know, I'm hearing that in different cancers now. Any comments in general about some of the newer trials, newer concepts, also IO and HER2 positive disease? Yelena, any thoughts?
Right. So this study elegantly actually allows both ctDNA and tissue. So whichever one comes quicker, ctDNA certainly is less cumbersome to the patients and lends itself to central confirmation, right? Because you can just quickly run the test. I do think that if you have, and we've showed that from our first line data with Pembro-Chaz, if you have high level of ERBB2 amplification in the ctDNA, you're the type of person who is going to do really well on HER2-directed therapy in terms of duration of response. So we do want those patients on the study. They will sort of stack the deck for the trial drug. Those patients are harder to find. It's a smaller proportion of the patients.
So Joe, I want to go on to another case of Dan's. This is a 68-year-old man. Again, new topic, you know, being a general medical oncologist, you wake up in the morning and go, what's been approved and who I have in my practice that I need to think about. This sort of flew by me all of a sudden, bam, in the GI meeting. I wasn't expecting it. FGFR2B mutations. Here's Dan.
68-year-old guy presented with dysphagia and found to have a mass in the distal esophagus, G-junction, extended the cardia, it was adenocarcinoma. The patient started because of FGFR2 amplification on FOLFOX with bemarituzumab and had a really nice response, a complete response, in fact. And this is now 30 months from diagnosis of stage 4 disease on first-line therapy. So questions I have for the panel is, do you routinely assess for FGFR2 amplification and how? By tissue, by blood, or both? And do you also check by immunohistochemistry? We do ophthalmology exams every 2 months, and he doesn't have any symptoms, but he has had some corneal changes. Of course, this drug's known unique toxicity is corneal keratitis, and about 20 to 30% of patients, generally speaking, it does resolve after stopping the drug. This patient, thankfully, has not had any of those issues. When using bemarituzumab, do you routinely have your patients seen by ophthalmologists? Do you do anything preemptively, eye drops? I would love to know what the panel thinks about mechanisms of resistance to the drug. What about combinations with other therapies, with particularly of interest might be with immunotherapy checkpoint inhibitor, very similar to anti-HER2 antibodies and checkpoint inhibitors, and potentially even the perioperative setting with curative intent.
So, Joe, I've been joking that, you know, we have cardio-oncology. We need to have ophthalmo-oncology. There's so many, all of a sudden, there's all these drugs with ophthalmic issues, you know, belimumab and myeloma, et cetera. So, first of all, let's just start out with the trial itself that was just presented by Zev Wainberg at the GI. I mean, I love the title, the name of it. I always like look at the names, the FIGHT clinical trial. Can you talk, Joe, about what they looked at there and what is bemarituzumab? And how often do you see FGFR2B mutations or alterations?
Yeah, I think at least one way to simplify things is that there won't be an FDA approval forthcoming as of yet. This was a randomized phase 2 study, though the signal was very promising. Bemarituzumab is engineered to have ADCC, promote ADCC in terms of targeting FGFR2, the receptor tyrosine kinase receptor, specifically the FGFR2B isoform. So in many ways, it is at least compared to TKIs against FGFR2, you don't see some of the metabolic toxicities, renal toxicities in terms of hyperphosphatemia. But there is still, yes, as you brought up, that on-target but off-tumor corneal toxicity. But this was straightforward in terms of either FOLFOX plus placebo or bemarituzumab. It was actually originally a randomized phase 3, but given the fact that FGFR2 gene amplification is a low proportion, they decided to just at least look for signal finding before continuing on to larger phase 3. So this got converted into a randomized phase 2 with PFS being the primary endpoint. But as you see in the Kaplan-Meier curves, very nice separation in terms of having bemarituzumab added to FOLFOX, improvements in clinical outcomes. Actually, there was also some interesting, call it target expression, dose response relationship. If you have higher protein overexpression, then actually the curves even separated further. But I think the other, kind of interesting aspect of this study is how they assess the FGFR2 biomarker. Normally you can actually capture it in terms of, I'll clarify, it's wild type gene sequence, but it's amplified, just like HER2, it's wild type. HER2, but the gene is amplified. It's just, very common for the genomic landscape of many gastroesophageal adenocarcinomas. But then usually gene amplification is still maybe 4%, 5%. But they also looked at protein overexpression by this novel IHC assay, apparently as a companion diagnostic. And there they captured 30% of patients who actually had protein overexpression, even not necessarily with gene amplification, but as you see with this, intent to treat analysis and all those who are even just protein overexpression positive by IHC, very nice responses and improvement in progression-free and overall survival. So it's a very interesting signal, very promising. And because FGFR2, we know it's a poor prognostic marker in terms of gene amplification, and really want a way to target that biomarker for this population of gastroesophageal cancer patients. But then now that we have also PD-1, I guess Dan brought up maybe trying to look ahead in the future, how can we, think of a phase 3 or moving forward? Because one question we don't know is, what is the overlap of PD-L1 overexpression with FGFR2 overexpression? At least for his case, the PD-L1 CPS was 2, but then if this was an esophageal cancer, do you give pembrolizumab with FOLFOX, or if you had access to this agent, do you give bemarituzumab? We really only have cross-trial comparisons to make to kind of deal with that conundrum. But I agree, because ADCC seems to be the predominant mechanism, or at least thought to be the mechanism of action, could we augment that with checkpoint inhibitors? But then we have to be careful about toxicities subsequently.
So, Yelena, any thoughts about this agent, where you think it's heading, what kind of benefits you think this is associated with it, and what are your thoughts about the tolerability issues, particularly these ophthalmic issues?
I've not had any experience with it. But from at least my interpretation of the data, it's interesting. It again highlights the importance of biomarker testing. Nivolumab is FDA approved in first line. FOLFOX Nivo is much better tolerated. And so as Joe pointed out, it will be important to understand what the overlap is between the biomarkers and the benefit. It seems to be, the toxicity benefit ratio is in favor of patients with the highest overexpression. Those patients typically don't have amplifications by NGS, so there's no point in looking. We don't have the validated biomarker in the clinic, and none of the pathologists are trained in how to test it. And so to me, I'm hoping this story will continue, but I'm getting sort of flashback to the MET story in gastric cancer of where things looked really nice. The biomarker was a little confusing, and then the phase 3 data didn't pan out.
So we'll see where things head with this very interesting agent that's really coming into a field that's a lot different than when the Exactly. When the trial was being designed. So, you design a trial based on what you think the reality is, but by the time you get through phase two, the reality is different. And I'd say the reality is good. It's certainly a lot more to talk about and figure out, that's for sure. But I think it's all leading to better patient outcomes. So Joe and Yelena, thank you so much for joining us. Subsequent to this recording, on April 16, 2021, the FDA approved nivolumab in combination with fluoropyrimidine and platinum-containing chemotherapy for advanced or metastatic gastric cancer, gastroesophageal junction cancer, and esophageal adenocarcinoma based on the results of the Phase 3 CheckMate 649 trial. This concludes our program. Special thanks to the faculty, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for this special AACR satellite meeting.